Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Gigabit Nation, Broadband Talk Radio. I'm your host, Craig Settles, and I want to welcome everyone in the audience today, and thank you for taking time to be with us. The mission of this show, as always, is to provide information to help public, private, and nonprofit organizations get faster, better broadband everywhere it needs to be. Those who have listened to this show over the past few months know that I continually come back to a theme of, you know, communities doing their own projects, raising their money, you know, doing all the things that need to happen, especially in rural areas and low-income areas where it just doesn't seem like the incumbents are going to be a player, are going to be a participant. And so we've got to think about self-reliance. And one of those stories that has come up in the state of Vermont, we've got a number of cities, towns, townships that have come together and have successfully raised their own money. They have created an organization to run the project. They've moved the process forward. They've built a network and continue to expand on that network infrastructure. And I am very honored and very pleased to have two of the primary drivers behind that project, Tim and Leslie Nolte, who are both here with us today. So both of you, welcome to the show.
Well,
thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Great. Now, we have talked before, you know, over the past couple of years, and, you know, I'm quite familiar with the project. But today, you know, for those who aren't familiar with the story, let's start with the basic background. I think it's in 2008 was when the communities came together to move this project forward. If we can just get a quick synopsis of, you know, what happened in the beginning and how you got to this point, and either one of you can take it away, whoever wants to tell the story.
Well, fairly quickly, the territory is 800 square miles, about 1,600 miles of road, and 55,000 people, 22,000 households and potential customers, businesses, and so forth. Initially, the 23 towns that comprised the joint venture attempted to raise the money all at once in the capital markets. We went with a public offering and for $90 million with Oppenheimer as our underwriter. As of early September 2008, we had commitments for $63 million of the $90 million, and we're closing in on the total when a little company called Lehman Brothers went bust and the world financial markets seized up. And with it, our $63 million that had been pledged and everything else disappeared. Shortly after that, Barack Obama was elected president and shortly after that passed the stimulus program for federal money for rural broadband. We attempted to get money from that program and failed. So about 2 years ago, we got sick and tired of going around with a begging bowl and being told no, and did what is a tradition in Vermont and said, well, you know, the big guys from the big cities won't help us anyway. Let's do it ourselves. So we pared the cost of the network down a great deal so that we would be able to start with a relatively small amount of money that we could raise from local people. And we got the number down. We got the minimum size way down, amazingly low, and managed to raise just under $1 million from local folks. This is investments, not charity. And built the beginnings of a network, and for roughly every 6 months since then, we've had additional capital raisings and raised a bit more and built a bit more and raised a bit more and built a bit more. As of now, we've raised $2.6 million altogether, starting our very first one was January 2011, so 18 months ago. We've now raised $2.6 million. We've built about 35 miles of fiber, hooked up 230-odd people, and we're building at the rate of, well, we have been building at the rate of 1 to 1.5 miles a week and hooking up 4 to 5 people a week. We're going to accelerate that to double, so we'll be doing something like 2.5 to 3 miles a week, hooking up anywhere from 6 to 10 people a week. And we'll keep accelerating because as we build, more and more people get interested and excited. So the amounts of money that we raise each time we go back have been increasing.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, the network will be large enough and the track record will be strong enough so that we can go back to the capital markets and hopefully raise enough to complete the project at one fell swoop rather than this very successful but rather slow bootstrap approach.
Mm-hmm. So for the community that sits back and goes, well, great, but how exactly did they do it? How easy is that? What's the process? I know you created a co-op. That was one of the – not a co-op. You created a nonprofit entity. So that was,
right.
I guess, what, step one. But how do you structure that, and how do you then leap from, okay, we've created this structure, this organization, to now we're going to go out and raise money from our local neighbors?
Tim, let me handle that.
Okay, you want to go?
We formed an organization which is called in Vermont an interlocal contract, wherein each of the 23 towns simply sign a contract amongst themselves that governs how they will conduct themselves and what their goals are. I believe that almost every state has a law that permits this kind of municipal undertaking, where each town by itself is too small and needs to create a joint venture with another town. So in Vermont, there are towns that have joint fire departments or libraries or solid waste management districts. And so this is in Vermont, and I'm sure in other rural areas, this is a familiar mechanism. But because towns, really wouldn't have the expertise to operate a telecom network, in Vermont, we were rather fortunate in that there was a separate nonprofit organization known as ValleyNet that had been started back in the 90s by some Dartmouth College graduates who first brought dial-up service to the upper Connecticut River Valley. The Connecticut River is the dividing line between New Hampshire and Vermont. And ValleyNet eventually in 1999 sold its dial-up service because by that point in time, dial-up had become a commodity. And so the ValleyNet had some funds to essentially help pay for staff for some initial skeleton staff that could support the efforts of the towns. Eventually, ValleyNet and the 23-town interlocal contract signed a contract between themselves called the Design Build Operate Agreement, which vests in ValleyNet the responsibility for handling all the operational aspects of the undertaking, while the 23-town interlocal contract is the governing body. It has bylaws. It sets policy. When it came to issuing debt, and this really got kicked off when EC Fiber, as the interlocal contract is known for short, the full name is East Central Vermont Community Fiber Optic Network, a bit of a mouthful. When EC Fiber wanted to apply for financing through the stimulus program, we felt and found that the ILC by itself was not robust enough for the taking on of debt, and so the ILC created a wholly owned limited liability company. And that limited liability company is the issuer of the promissory notes that are the mechanism for community financing. So through all these rounds of financing that Tim has described, the EC Fiber LLC has issued unsecured promissory notes available to any investor in units of $2,500. And of the, we estimate that about half the investors who have invested in EC Fiber have invested $5,000 or less. So that is, this is really an undertaking supported by many, many small investors sprinkled throughout our territory.
Mm-hmm. And how, I don't know how we measure degree of difficulty, but was this a fast process to get people to grasp or and then participate in, or was there a, I don't know, significant education and then finally people got on board? I mean, how was the... How was that 1-2 dance?
It took a long. We've been at this for over 4 years, mainly because of the failed effort to raise money in the public markets and then the failed effort to raise money from the stimulus. Once we decided to do it ourselves, rural Vermonters understand that. So that actually hasn't been that hard. And the promissory notes, which are sort of like bonds. They're not legally bonds, but they're like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because EC Fiber is a municipal entity, it's owned entirely by towns, those bond, those promissory notes are tax-exempt, both the federal and state taxes, and they pay 6% a year. So for 15 years, it's a 15-year note. So that's not a bad investment, and just on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And people are desperate for broadband, so they want the service. And here's an opportunity to make a pretty good rate of return while contributing to bringing essential service to your community. So it hasn't been a hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's still, for rural people, I mean, we're not talking fabulously wealthy people. These are ordinary folks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've had very little contribution from... Well, we haven't had many contributions from the very poorest people, but we haven't had many contributions from the richest either. It's been the middle class that's really stepped up on this, and this, it hasn't been a hard sell. People understand, you know, they have mortgages and they borrow money for their cars, and they understand what a loan is. They understand amortization and principal and interest, and except in this case, they're lending the money instead of borrowing it. So
mm-hmm.
it hasn't been very hard. The artist,
there is legwork. I mean, there are many, many, you know, community meetings, townwide meetings, but really a lot of it is done by word of mouth. Because we've been at this for 4 years, we have a well-known established brand. We've had very good support of local press. So we run into people all the time who, oh, I read about you in the paper. Oh, yes, I know who you are. So, and then once we started building the network, people who live just a mile beyond where we've built, because our maps are posted on the website, start calling us and saying, well, what's it going to take for you to get to me? And we say, well, have you got some neighbors who might be interested? And then we go out and we hold a little meeting in somebody's kitchen or living room or whatever, and go through the program and explain it, and then one thing leads to another.
Hmm. Okay. So it's a it is a process, but then as I tell people, it's a lot of hard work, but it's a doable process. It's manageable.
Yes.
You can see an endpoint. You can see progress. People are I assume people are patient. I mean, I know there's another place that I understand that, you know, once it starts, you know, everybody then wants it all at once, which, you know, you kind of have to manage people's expectations a little bit. But, you know, it's...
Well, that's
like
true. But remember, they understand that, you know, we don't have, you know, big money bags behind us, that
right.
We can only build what for the money we raise.
Right, but they understand
and
that.
Okay, well, how much? And it's $25,000 a mile to build the fiber.
Yes.
And take six people.
Right.
And so we
the other
say,
thing I would
got,
say,
you know, get a couple of people together. Typically, we have anywhere from 10 to 14 people per mile in our territory, which is average for most rural areas in the United mm-hmm. States. And most rural areas where there are actual people, it's not average for the Nevada desert, but it's average for, that's about the average for the rural areas of the entire United States east of the Great Plains. And so six people per mile, you know, we need $25,000, and we'll come to your house. And people say, okay, we understand, and mostly they do it. And it's neighborhood by neighborhood. People are comfortable going to their neighbors, the people on their road, and say, look, why don't we get together and raise this money and bring this to us? Mm-hmm. And it, as Leslie says, as the network builds out, more and more people find themselves just a mile beyond it, a mile and a half beyond it. And so more and more neighborhoods are, oh, that's almost here. Let's get together. This is what it takes. Mm-hmm. And they do understand that this is a community exercise, because there are lots of community exercises in Vermont. It goes back 250 years. There's nothing new about that. Mm-hmm. The main new thing about this is that you actually get a rate of return for it. It's not a charitable contribution.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I would say, Craig, the point I wanted to make is rather than say it's a lot of hard work, I would say it's a lot of work, but it's enormous fun.
Right.
Because to me, I say to people, it's like feeding starving children. When people who've been on dial-up see the prospect of fiber optic coming to their doorstep, I mean, we literally have had people say, oh, you're coming to my road next week or next month. Tell the guys that I'll have beer and sandwiches for them whenever they come by. It's that kind of response that you get that is people are so excited and so appreciative that it doesn't feel like hard work at all.
We get emails all the time saying you've made the biggest difference in my life of anything that's happened in the last 10 years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now what would be two key things to do to get this process rolling effectively, but also what are two challenges?
Well, interestingly, the network, the technical challenges are the easiest part. I mean, building these kind of networks is now becoming pretty cut and dry. The equipment's off the shelf. The technology's off the shelf. It isn't that hard to build them. It's the political and organizing that's the hardest, and the financing. And this is more about community organizing than it is about high tech. You have to run the network, and you have to have some people who know how to do that. But again, there are hundreds and hundreds of small telephone companies and cable family-run cable companies all over the United States, most of whom do just fine. So I don't want to make it sound like that's easy, like building it and running it is trivial, but it's not rocket science. You know, the big companies tend to try and mystify it by making it sound like nobody can do it, but it isn't something that can't be done by most communities if they put their minds to it. The hardest part is the organizing of it, the organizing of the community, getting support from the community, having a structure that's rooted in community institutions and so forth. That's the hardest part.
Hmm.
And then in some cases, not in Vermont, but in other states, where you have to withstand a political onslaught from the cable and telephone companies.
But Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that in Vermont, we're fortunate in that we're remote enough that we're not particularly attractive to the really big boys who've done so much damage elsewhere. And so we haven't been under frontal attack the way we saw Lafayette in Louisiana or what we saw in North Carolina. That just would not go over very well in Vermont. And in fact, I think if such companies tried to behave that way, it would boomerang on them. That's just the nature of the culture here. We've been able to do this incremental process without having to face that kind of direct onslaught.
Okay. Now, what are some of the, key things to watch out for if you're a community trying to do this and you don't want to run afoul of, regulators and all the rest?
Well, a really big thing, as I say, in Vermont, we have one of the most liberal laws in the state, in the country, as to what municipalities are allowed to do in telecom. They can do almost anything they want. However, we have very, very restrictive law as to how they can finance it. So in Vermont, it is absolutely stone-cold illegal to use any taxpayer funds at all for telecommunications.
Mm-hmm.
So some people think that's a nail in the coffin or a hole in the bottom of the boat. But in fact, it's not, because fiber optic networks can be financially self-sustaining and feasible in rural areas without any taxpayer money at all. And to me, if I were doing this in some other state, even if it allowed the use of taxpayer funds, I would counsel against it, because that is the first thing that draws the fire of the incumbents. They scream and yell and say, oh, this is unfair, it's no level playing field, because towns can use taxpayer money to give an unfair disadvantage to Comcast. I mean, give me a break. Comcast is far bigger than the most states, let alone towns. Nevertheless, they say that, and people start to get very worried if taxpayer money is going to go into these things. So I actually think it's a good thing for somebody who starts a community network like this to eschew using explicitly say, we will not use taxpayer money. We are only going to use private money. And there are two reasons that come out of that. One, you disarm the political opponents. And number two, to the extent that you succeed in raising money from local people, you've created a cadre of local citizen investors and voters who have a very, very big interest in making sure that your company succeeds,
mm-hmm.
and in resisting the political arguments. Whereas if it's a town using taxpayer money, it's harder to get that kind of really down in the trenches support. People who will fight to the death to support the company because they got their own money in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so this is sort of counterintuitive, but that's not the first time in my life I've been counterintuitive. I actually think a good thing to do is to organize a strong community organization and then state from the beginning you're not going to do it with taxpayer money. You're going to do mm-hmm. it with people money.
And that's fine. I mean, I know that
outsourcing, if you will.
It's one of those things I know the people to the left of me get disgruntled about is, well, we should be doing this because it's the right thing to do and this and that, which is true. However, it is not necessarily politically expedient, and you get into all these moaning and complaining fights, and it's like, who needs the aggravation?
Most of those folks aren't actually doing anything. They're just talking.
The other thing is that this is a business. And to make it successful, it requires business discipline.
Right.
And with proper business discipline, these things will pay back the investors, and ultimately, we expect, return something to the towns by way of any kind of economic surplus once the network is fully built out. And, we believe that kind of business discipline is good and healthy and builds a strong enterprise and builds a stronger organization.
Mm-hmm. And keeping that in mind, I think, is important because then, you don't make the same kind of decisions, obviously, that a Comcast or a large incumbent makes, but you do make those decisions important for the survivability of the network.
Right.
When you
absolutely.
Run it as a business. And I
absolutely.
Think
I do think so, these things should be, Leslie's right, these things should be run by people with business experience and business discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And who understand the value of a dollar or and a quarter and of a dime,
That makes all the sense in the world. I think it's, you know, as I see it, and you can tell me, you know, because you obviously talk to lots of people talk to you. I see this as the evolution. You know, I see two types of evolution. One is communities building a structure to finance their own. I think that as more stories like yours are told, people will be more comfortable with that. But I also think that some variation on the public-private partnership, when done correctly, as in you structure relationships that don't ultimately screw over the townspeople later inadvertently, but the public-private partnership has a role to play, and then more people will feel comfortable.
Yeah, this is a public EC Fiber is a public private partnership.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the towns actually own the network. They are the owners of the network, and they issue the debt. Even though it's not that no taxpayer money's in it, mm-hmm. the town-created entity, EC Fiber, is a municipal entity. It issues the debt, and it owns the network, and it sets the policy. But the designing, building, and operating of the network is done by a business.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nonprofit business, but it's still a business. I mean,
right.
It's a corporation and it's a business. Mm-hmm. And it has a 15-year history of being successful as a business. So the marrying of those, and all the money is private.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a public-private partnership, just of a somewhat, you know, specific kind.
Totally understandable.
I think this might be a good point, very briefly, just to go into a little bit of the details of the governance structure, because it will put some meat on the bones of the partnership idea that you've raised. Every town select board, which is the elected officials of the town, every town select board names a delegate and an alternate to the governing board of EC Fiber. That governing board meets every month, and the meetings under Vermont law are open to any member of the public. That governing board also elects an executive committee, which meets almost every week by conference call. As I said earlier, the governing board and the executive committee have to approve the design, build, operate contract with ValleyNet, the operating company. There are also authority levels wherein if ValleyNet wants to sign a $100,000 contract, for example, it has to go back to the executive committee, or in this case, to get approval, you know, for certain levels of expenditure. When the decision to issue these promissory notes was made, that had to be approved by the governing board. So any of these seminal decisions are ultimately made by representatives of the towns, even though the day-to-day operating business decisions are made by the operating partner, ValleyNet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think it was, you know, it appears to be, and again, you know, not just here, but in other places that are doing something similar, those are all the keys to success. You know, that there is accountability to the community. There's an understanding that, you know, the day-to-day operations are probably not something that you want the, you know, all the neighbors to have a hand in, but the key decisions are clearly ones that the community needs to make. And ultimately, always, you know, that there has to be safeguards so that, you know, no one individual or entity or whatever can take that structure, that asset, away from the community.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So we're all on the same page here for sure. Now let's talk about the community organizing aspect of it. You mentioned that it's, you know, it takes a lot of work, which, you know, I will definitely agree with. But how are, you know, what are some tips for structuring your community organization effort? Do you get a small committee, a large committee? Do you delegate everything? Do you delegate half the stuff? I mean, how do you make the mechanics work?
When we started out, it really was an activist group of about 40 or 50 people that started the thing. And when we formed it, when it went from being an activist movement to being a formal organization, and that happened when all 23 towns voted in favor of joining the contract, then most of those activists became the delegates from their respective towns. So we had a built-in community organizing group. And I definitely feel strongly that things like this, real aggressive, you know, proactive actions, tend not to come out of political organizations like a town council. They tend to come from you know, activist groups of people in the towns or the county that care a lot about it. And what you want to get is a bunch of very active people who care and who are rooted in the community. Once the town is sort of signs on to it in a more passive way, then those activists become the town representatives. And so we've had from the beginning a built-in cadre. I mean, the representatives and the alternates from 23 towns, 46 people, and plus some hangers-on and other people around. So we've had a cadre of 50, 60 people spread out throughout this 800-square-mile territory who are knowledgeable and actively committed. And they started as a community group, as a citizens group, just an activist citizen group, and morphed into the governing board of the whole organization. And that's a real, I mean, I wouldn't claim we planned it. A lot of the good things that we've done have happened by accident as we sort of went along. But that's a really good way to think about it, that you start this with an activist group and structure your organization so that the activists can become the governing board certified by the town. And that way you keep the enthusiasm, you keep the connection to the, and you keep knowledgeable people. I mean, all our governing board members are knowledgeable, either in finance or business or telecom or software building or software development or computers. I mean, they're a very high-grade bunch of people and know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's important.
A lot of what has helped build the organization is this wonderful talent pool, which I'm sure you'll find almost everywhere. So our logo was created by volunteers. Up until recently, all our press relations were handled on a volunteer basis. Our website was done by volunteers, and now our website is being overhauled and upgraded, also by volunteers. And
the legal work was mostly volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
The legal work is non-trivial in this.
So, you know, this is by reaching out and finding where the talent pool is and using your local talent, again, you build loyalty and commitment. I think we've been extremely fortunate to not have had too much, you know, power plays or ego jockeying or any of that kind of thing. We've our treasurer is the former vice president of a bank. I mean, there's just, you know, there's just deep, deep talent that has been willing, been enthusiastic and willing to help build this. The other thing I would say is that a lot of the energy, this wonderful positive energy behind DC Fiber, comes out of a concern that without modern telecommunications, these communities are in danger of dying. And you will find that in much of rural America. People who value their rural way of life and their rural communities want to keep them strong. And so it's a kind of self-interest that helps drive this level of commitment. And we've been very fortunate here to be able to tap into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's very good advice for our listeners, and you know, sound, and I, again, I will say that, you know, in talking to others in other communities, you know, they have voiced similar kinds of concerns. I'm sure you're familiar with the Wired West project in Western Massachusetts, which is very similar in the sense of, you know, 20, I forget how many of their towns
50,
have come together.
50. They got 50 towns.
50
oh,
towns.
Up 100. Oh, geez. Talk about herding cats.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, we work with them quite a bit. Yeah, we know them well. It's
so
just
now,
over the border.
So now, one of your biggest fans from the UK has joined us, Chris Conder with the Barn Project, which reminds me of a question I want to make sure I ask, which is the physical build-out part, okay? For the Barn Project in the UK, I mean, literally the farmers are out digging the trenches.
Right.
But you guys have granite, so that's not a doable thing. How do you
right.
guys deal with the build-out in Vermont, given all the terrain issues? And then also, you know, are the people who do that work, are they also local, or do you have to go outside for that?
We're fortunate. We put ours on existing utility poles. And in the United States, we have a federal law absolutely mandating that the owners of public utility poles permit if you're licensed, if you're a proper licensed telecom provider, you must be allowed on. Now, they can delay a bit, and they can charge money, and they can fiddle around, but they absolutely must, by law, allow you on. In the UK, when we visited the Barn Project, we saw all these wonderful power poles across the countryside, all with nothing on them but power. We salivated at all these nice empty poles, but in the UK, you're not allowed to go on them. So that's really a terrible shame. And in the UK, it would be very feasible and much cheaper to simply attach to the poles, but that's not allowed in the UK law, so they have to bury it. Fortunately, at least in Lancashire, the burying is feasible. For us, it wouldn't be. Well, it is at a cost of, you know, an astronomical cost. It costs us about $3 a foot to hang fiber, and it would cost us five times that to bury it. So we're lucky that we don't have to bury it. And our construction is done by professionals. It's a local Vermont company.
Yeah, we actually have a contract with a design build fiber construction firm called Matrix Design Group. They have done the engineering, and they are doing the actual physical construction. So ValleyNet, you know, gets the pole attachment licenses from the existing utilities, and then Matrix goes out and actually hangs the fiber. And they also do the connection at the customer premises with our own staff. So it's sort of a distributed effort. But this is a professional organization, and they have, it's actually a newly created Vermont company that is an offshoot of a company based in New Jersey, and they've been able to find and recruit local staff here in Vermont, knowledgeable people. You know, when a company pays their employees properly and treats them properly, and other companies are not doing that, it's very easy to attract quality staff. And so staffing has not been an issue.
Now, the price you quoted for hanging the fiber, is that pretty much standard across the U.S.?
No, we're pretty cheap. It's standard among those people, those companies that have had to do this with their own money and therefore have had to think really hard about how to do it efficiently. When you do it with cheap or free money from the feds, then you don't think very much about how to do it as cheap as possible. But there are certainly a number of other companies around in the U.S. that, like us, have had to stretch their pennies who are getting these same numbers. But if you go to Verizon and ask what it costs, they'll tell you $40,000 or $50,000 a mile for aerial plant. And we're doing it for 15 to 16, 17 is a bad number. Say between $15,000 and $17,000 a mile. And there are others who are doing that too. I mean, it's not a weird number. It's just not what AT&T and Verizon pay.
So about 17,000.
We're much more efficient than they are. Much more efficient.
No,
but when you do
sense.
It with your own money raised from your neighbors, you bloody well, you try real hard.
That's good. That's good. So it's basically knowing how to stretch a penny. Well, I have another question relative to budget. When you are establishing the budget, what factors do you put into place? An estimation on if we get X number of customers, we have to spend X, or we will spend X and get to hopefully Y number of customers. I mean, what's the budgeting logic that goes in?
Well, we don't. Yeah, I mean, I've spent most of my life in finance and telecom. So most of the time in telecom, you're dealing with larger sums of money and money which has been raised first and then you spend. But we don't have that luxury. We basically raise as we go and build as we go, mile by mile. And it's at this point, it's really, you know, what group of neighbors can come up with $25K a mile? And the 25K is roughly $17,000 per mile for the pass, what we call the pass. That's the fiber going down the road, and $1,000 each to hook them up. And six people per mile is what we – six paying customers per mile at the end of the day, not necessarily the first immediately, but within a year or two, is what we need for break even. And six times 1,000 is 6,000, and plus 17,000 for the pass, that's 23,000, $2,000 cushion to make sure you can deal with the unexpected, events, and you've got 25K a mile. So we raise the 25K a mile, and we spend it as we go. We don't have a big bank account from which we draw down. We go along piece by piece. And the thing is, as the networks, you know, slowly inches out into the countryside, every mile you go, another bunch of people are now close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as you build the network out, kind of like the veins of a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
So as you go further out along each vein you're reaching another group. But now you have more and more veins. So the number of people that are close to your network grows exponentially. It's a square function.
Mm-hmm.
And so each time we raise money, we're now raising from a larger number of people who are close to the network and who get excited and say, oh, you know, sit down with their neighbors and say, if we can only come up with 25K, we can all have this. And there are more and more of those neighborhoods. It makes for an awful lot of evenings in people's kitchens, but and labor was. That's actually fun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's great
now,
fun.
Now, one of the things in a report that I did recently on alternative ways of funding broadband, one of the folks I talked to said, you know, they try to figure out the total cost for where they want to build, and they figure if they can raise enough to build a third of that network. So, you know, if it's $10 million, they'll say, well, you know, if we can raise $2.5 million so that we can build a quarter of the network, that will give us the momentum then to be able to start selling services and move faster to self.
That's what we're finding. Yeah.
Okay.
We're experiencing exactly that. Exactly that. You keep raising the amount of money that you raise each time goes up, so this accelerates. That process that you describe is exactly what we're experiencing and what we're riding on right now.
Interesting, Leslie. You had a point too.
Well, yeah, I was just going to sort of circle back to a statement Tim made earlier, which was that we did our initial fundraise when we were starting out on this project, the very first round of financing, we tried to figure to do a business planning model together with our design build firm, Matrix, to figure out what was the smallest feasible size of project that we could build that would be self-sustaining over time, and how much money did we need to raise to meet those criteria. So it's sort of similar. I mean, this other enterprise you described came up with a rule of thumb that was a third. Well, since we know, if we had used a simple rule of thumb, we would have said, oh my gosh, we've got to raise, you know, $8 or $10 million, and then we would have given up. We approached it a little differently and said, what is the smallest feasible scale that could be self-sustaining? And it took a lot of iterations, you know, to try to figure that out. But eventually we did.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask a
question. And that size was under $1 million.
So let me ask another another question here and change tack just a little bit. In the U.S. at the moment, we have, I don't know, several thousands of miles of middle-mile fiber that's being built. And I keep asking the question, and nobody in D.C. Tens of thousands, even worse. But I keep asking this question, and, you know, in D.C. circles, okay, so there seems to be this article of faith that if we build this middle mile out to various areas, that magically a last mile provider will show up. D.C.
Yeah.
D.C. itself has to be
absolute rubbish.
I'm sorry.
Absolute rubbish.
Okay.
Craig,
well, let me finish
rubbish.
My question. Now, let me finish my question because I want to establish the context here. Okay. So in D.C. is probably an interesting example because they are building a 100-gig network. It's like, you know, 100 nukes to basically build out one little small area. But they, and in rural communities where, you know, they're looking at maybe just a gig middle mile network, are assuming, it seems, that like Comcast and Verizon will be the providers that will step in and provide the last mile, while ignoring small local companies because they're small and they don't bring in the same, you know, flash and gas as the big guys do. Are we destined for trouble?
It's worse, absolutely. It's complete balderdash. It's actually worse than that because these middle mile networks come in and cherry pick the biggest customers. So it actually makes it harder for anybody else to come in and cover the rest. Because your best, you know, your hospitals, your few business customers, the government, have been cherry-picked. So what the small company that's actually providing service to people has an even harder job. So it's not only stupid, it's actually nefarious, this middle-mile nonsense.
So in essence,
it's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. Exactly what you expect out of inside the Beltway types who listen to lobbyists.
So basically, if they had just done the middle mile and left it at that, leaving then the institutions alone, the institutions would have been the ROI factor for small companies actually providing
the
last mile.
That's right. So they've made it harder. Consider a situation. Leslie and I spent early part of our lives in East Africa. Consider a situation where you're involved in economic development in rural Kenya, and there are a lot of small farmers there raising bananas and cotton and coffee and so forth. And unfortunately, they have a hard time getting their stuff to market because they've got nothing but dirt tracks, and they have to take their stuff to market on the backs of their bicycles.
Mm.
And what they need is roads, but they don't need highways. They need little roads where they can take a motorbike or a little car or a little pickup or something and get their stuff to market. And along comes this really great idea for a middle mile service. And it's a 6-lane, zillion-dollar highway that goes from nowhere to nowhere and doesn't have any off-ramps.
I see.
And they say, well, if we build this middle mile, then along comes somebody will come along and build the roads that the farmers actually need to get their stuff to market. That's bullshit. Nobody builds that road. It just becomes a white elephant. It's just a white elephant. And most of these things are just white elephants. We have one in Vermont. $30 million to a private profit-making company. They built a middle-mile network right down the same highways that all the other middle-mile. There are already four middle-mile networks in this state. And they built another middle-mile network down exactly the same roads that all the other middle-mile networks had. They're providing no service, and they're taking the they're going to the hospitals and the you know the VA hospital and the state this and the that and actually offering quite high prices and no service for any ordinary people because they can't. The network isn't designed that way any more than you can take things to market over a six lane highway that has no off ramps. So it's absolute baloney, and it, why did it happen? Because the incumbents don't want federal money going to help final mile service because that's the core of their business. And they don't care about these middle miles because they know it doesn't do them any harm. They're not a threat. They don't provide any service. They're just white elephants. And to the extent that they have any use, the big incumbents will use them for their own long distance. And so they're no threat. This is a pure myth, pure balderdash, purveyed in Washington by the incumbents and bought and believed by the ignorant people in Washington who inhabit the bureaucracies and the staffs of the Congress. It's complete nonsense.
So
six lane highways from nowhere to nowhere in northern Ghana, white elephant.
But now, what's the solution? How can we somehow take what is a really bad play and salvage something from it?
Very hard to do because these middle-mile networks are not engineered like a local universal distribution system. Once you've built one of these middle-mile networks and engineered it in a way to be efficient for middle-mile purposes, it cannot economically be re-engineered and used for local service. It is actually cheaper to build a whole new network than to try and re-engineer a middle-mile one. They're basically wasted. I mean, they can still be used, you know, for those few people who want to buy it through routes, they're useful for that. But there's a lot of that stuff out there. Say, in Vermont, we got four major through-route networks all over the state, and the feds gave $30 million to another profit member to build a fifth one down the same routes. I mean,
is the reality then that they basically put out specs for building a middle-mile network, but they developed the specs in such a way that there are no, even though they talked about them being...
If you design the network, that's right, but it's complete nonsense because the fed types that write these rules don't know what they're talking about. They're just ignorant. They're lawyers. I don't know what they're talking about. They've never engineered, built, or run a network in their lives. And if you build a middle-mile network and engineer it to be efficient for middle-mile purposes, it cannot be used for local. If you engineer it to be capable of local, then it's an extremely expensive, gold-plated middle-mile network. But you can't do it efficiently for middle mile and also do local. If you build a local network, which is efficient for local purposes, it is very easy to package onto it an extra number of fibers that give you through-mile capability. So a universal local distribution network can easily have middle-mile capability added to it cheaply and efficiently. But you can't engineer the other way. It's a one-way engineering option, not a two-way engineering option.
And so there we are.
Yeah, there's millions, tens of billions of dollars being spent around the country. And I won't say they're completely useless. I mean, they're useful for middle-mile purposes, as long as they're not being built where places where there are five options already. And Vermont, there are already four options. So
right.
The fifth one. Silly. That's not true everywhere. So in some cases, there is indeed a need for middle mile capacity, in which case the money isn't being wasted. But don't pretend that somehow or other you're creating a fertile environment for local to happen. You're not. You're just not.
Were there no
You're
voices?
Doing a middle mile job. Good. Where in the middle mile job is needed, good. It's not wasted. But you're not bringing service to ordinary people at all. You're not even helping it.
And so this holds true then for wireless as well as wired last mile options?
Wireless is a different game. Wireless is in its there is no such thing as middle mile wireless.
What I meant was,
by its very nature, a final distribution network.
Hold on one second. If your middle mile
network is engineered to serve cell towers, that's the way it's laid out.
Okay.
Then that's helpful for cell service. That's cool. Now, cell service isn't all that useful for broadband. Even 4G isn't that useful for broadband.
But
it's still a good thing. Capital G, capital T, extending cell service to rural areas which have poor is a good thing. But middle mile networks are not normally engineered that way either. I mean, cell towers are up on mountains and off in weird places. Middle mile networks are engineered to go from large town to large town by the shortest routes. So it's not often that middle mile networks are engineered to be optimal for cell tower support. But to the extent that a fiber network is supporting cell towers, that's good for cell service. Who's against that? I mean, I'm for it. It's a good thing. But
it's just not accomplishing the mission.
It's accomplishing a mission, not the mission they claim they're accomplishing.
Right. We've been sold a mission, and we're looking at some really dire options here in the final analysis. And I guess the thing I was trying to get to was that wireless last mile is not going to be served by this middle mile shortcoming either, right? I mean, you're basically...
By and large, no.
No.
I mean, there may be cases. I don't know every single project, but there may be cases where the middle mile network has been designed with the view to support lots of cell towers all over the country. But that's rare. I mean, middle mile networks go from large user to large user, from large town to large town. And that along that route, there are very rarely that... That's not where the cell towers are. The cell towers are in places picked to be optimal for radio propagation. And it's unusual that a middle mile network would be designed to be optimal for the purpose of supporting cell towers. Hmm. But that's different. I mean, cell towers are supported by networks that are designed to support cell towers.
Well then, and with that...
You don't run 144 strands of cable to support a cell tower.
Right.
You do run 144 strands, and it would be silly if you were if you're building a middle mile network to pick up, you know, all the towns of 50,000 or 100,000 people in, let's say, Nebraska. You wouldn't necessarily, and you're running 144 strand cable. Well, the location of the cell towers is different. You're certainly not going to run 144 strands of cable all out to all these little places with their cell towers. So it's a different design task, and it generates different economics and different engineering specifications. None of them are bad. I mean, a network that supports cell towers is a good thing, but it's not a middle mile network. It's a cell tower support system.
Right. We just need to be clearer on the nomenclature, because clearly we've been promised versus what we got are two different things.
Yeah.
And then with that, unfortunately, down note, we'll have to come back and have another interview later to kind of leave on a more positive thing. I mean, I appreciate you guys talking about, you know, what you've done, because clearly the work that you've done is extremely positive, and it's also very good and very instructive to the rest of the country. And as you've described the trials of the middle mile that we were promised but not getting, it sounds like more and more people need to revert to what you guys are doing and just do it themselves. And,
right.
and
the
for
job
that message,
is bring service to people.
Excellent.
And that job requires clear focus and projects that are designed to do that job.
Excellent. And I want to thank both of you for being our guests today, Leslie and Tim. It's been very informative. Thank you to our audience, and thank you to Team Fischl for being our sponsor. We will see you again sometime soon, and hopefully I'll have you folks back on the show. Have a great day, everybody.
Sure.
We'll talk again.
Enjoyed it.
Craig.
See you, Craig.
All right. Take care. Bye.